Hello and welcome to AI and the Future of Work, the weekly podcast where we discuss the future of work with entrepreneurs, executives, venture capitalists, and journalists. I'm your host, Dan Turchin, CEO of Insight Finder, the AI-first system of intelligence for IT operations, and executive chairman of PeopleRain, the leading platform for automating IT and HR employee service. We're trying a new format for this week's podcast. I'm sharing a panel discussion I hosted with Dell, Credit Suisse, and Snowflake about the future of AI in IT operations. I enjoyed the discussion so much that I thought I'd share it with you. Now, I remember this time when I was a kid in the 80s, and I snuck into the locker room at a San Diego soccer game. It was at the height of the MISL's popularity. For those non-soccer fans, or those too young to remember, which I think is most of you, there was a time when the major indoor soccer league was kind of a big deal. It wasn't quite the NFL, but a big deal in an indie kind of way, before the MLS existed. Now, it was the playoffs, and all my heroes were 30 yards away from where me and hundreds of other kids were waving jerseys, hoping for a Julie V or a Steve Jungle autograph. They were my Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers for just a few short years. To get autographs, I needed some unfair advantage. I couldn't wait through the off-season and risk not having my jersey signed. So I made my own luck. I knew Joseph. He was a security guard at the sports arena in San Diego, because we'd geek out before most games about the team. Joseph became a friend over the months and years, and he happened to have full access to the locker room. So Joseph escorted me into the locker room that evening and introduced me to my heroes. He helped me fill the front and back of my jersey with the team's autographs. And as a bonus, we won the MISL that evening. Believe it or not, this has everything to do with IT operations. IT leaders create unfair advantages for themselves and their teams. They rise to the occasion when asked to do the impossible. The group I hosted a few weeks back shared their own stories about how they're using AI to do the impossible. When the easy answer to the board or the CIO is never, or no way, or that's impossible, they find their own Joseph to escort them to the pantheon of IT greatness. Listen and learn how, for example, Justin from Snowflake prepared to monitor an architecture that scales elastically to accommodate a business growing at breakneck speed amid a surge in demand generated by the world's largest tech IPO, which resulted in an unfathomable $70 billion valuation. Learn how Liz from Dell and Luca from Credit Suisse deliver reliable, scalable IT solutions for millions of users who depend on them to buy stuff online and process time-sensitive financial transactions. These three put on a masterclass in how to use AI to create an unfair advantage in IT operations and deliver the impossible. What they do daily is much more impressive than a kid with a jersey breaking into the locker room for autographs. As for my beloved Sockers, tweet me at dturchin if you're also an MISL fan. I will track down Joseph and we can reminisce together. That's about enough from me. Enjoy the episode. And as always, thanks for listening. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where it is you are listening from. I am Dan Turchin, the CEO of Insight Finder, the AI-first system of intelligence for IT operations. I'm quarantined in Mountain View, California. I know we've got people who have joined from all over the world. We got a special event for you today. We've got three expert panelists. We will introduce ourselves in just a moment, but I thought I'd provide a little bit of a preamble before we jump into the discussion. We're going to be talking today about the past, the present, and the future of IT operations. Specifically, what are some of the innovative new ways that large organizations are using technology to predict and prevent outages? So a few framing questions. We'll address these as we get deeper into the session. So why does IT ops matter? I know it seems like kind of a platitude. All of us are certainly in the space, but I think it's a good time to take a step back, particularly in the middle of the shift to remote work and everything else that's going on. Why does it matter?
but also importantly, where have we been as a community? Where are we now? And what does the future look like? Now, why are we having this discussion now? Well, I'll give you five reasons, and I'm sure you have many of your own, but I think in terms of framing the discussion, I think these are all important things to consider. So increasingly, cloud systems are independent. So we're all responsible for, at some point, being dependent on someone else's code. So whether that's integrations via API or via public clouds, or even sometimes private clouds, there's always some kind of system that our systems are dependent on. And so thinking through being responsible for availability and performance at a time when everything is interdependent means that the role of IT ops has become a lot more complex. Application architectures, well, this goes without saying, but they're increasingly complex. We're injecting new points of failure, seems like every day, whether it's new automated forms of testing, or we're experimenting with serverless architectures, or we're doing CI/CD continuously, pushing code continuously, doing delivery. These patterns just didn't exist several years ago, and they're all developed or designed to be able to accommodate the insatiable appetite that our end customers, our employees have for digital services. But nobody first came to IT ops and said, hey, just want to give you a heads up. Things are going to get a little bit wild here in the coming quarters. They just said, we're going to sprint toward, these new digital services. Our business is digital first and keep the lights on. And so we've all had to innovate and think about, what that means as service providers, as internal resources. Now, the good news is we're getting the message through. So increasingly, IT ops has a seat around the boardroom table because the CEO and the board wants to know, are we capable of delivering these digital services at scale? Not because all of a sudden the CEO and the board became technologists, but they do realize the impact of downtime. And they realize that the line between them and their competitors is razor thin. It's a click away. And so a little bit of downtime, you see the number here. I know this is a common number. You've probably heard varieties on this, but $10,000 and up per minute of downtime. The availability and performance of key digital services is what really determines, are you a leader? Are you a laggard? Is your churn going up? Is your churn going down? What are people saying about you on social media? You don't want to be in the headlines because of some kind of a breach or an outage. And that's all of our jobs. So like I said, we've got a panel of experts here with us today to discuss what it means to manage in the face of some of these trends and how you scale up or scale out an organization when the world is changing so quickly. So our expert panelists, I'm going to start by introducing them and have them share a little bit about their background. We'll start with the left here. Justin Fitzhugh, welcome to the panel. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Nice to meet everybody. My name is Justin Fitzhugh. I run cloud engineering and quality at Snowflake. We're a large-scale cloud data warehouse company. Over the years, I've worked at various different organizations from Mozilla to a company called Instart Logic, doing CDN work and Jive software, where I was their CIO. I'm always focused on kind of back-end platform engineering and infrastructure automation and such. So that's my background. I'm excited to be here.
Glad to have you here. Liz from North Texas, welcome to the panel.
Hi,
you want to introduce yourself?
So I am quarantined in North Texas, and I am the Vice President of Digital Solutions in the Dell Technologies Managed Services Practice. So, I've been with Dell for 5 years, and I was with EMC when Dell acquired EMC 5 years ago, and prior to that, I have spent my entire career in managed services. So have a lot of experience with customers always looking for the new greatest shiny object, and have always been in the transformation space. So always looking for new innovations that can bring customers value, can also, you know, reduce the amount to service their IT operations. And we're finding that the cycle is going so quickly, more quickly than a lot of the humans involved can keep up with, because the rate of change is very fast. You know, we've just reached a point where we can't reasonably keep the environment available unless we're using a lot of the AI ops technology, just because the sheer volume of things that are happening in these complex environments make it just impossible to do it any other way. So, you know, on-prem clouds or public clouds, you know, with all the application stacks, it's a fun problem to solve. Let's put it that way.
Well, thanks for joining us. Last but certainly not least, Luca from Credit Suisse. You want to introduce yourself?
Very good. So I'm Luca Blanzoli. I'm a director at Credit Suisse in the investment banking technology division. I sit in core engineering and architecture, being always focused on process engineering and automation, from the business process engineering to DevOps automation. I hear you loud and clear, and you know, some of the latest effort in creating SRE departments in Credit Suisse, and I hear folks saying that outages should not happen twice, and I think it's time to switch paradigm, and that you should be able to have no outage at all. The outages not happening twice is not good enough for us, as you said. You know, we don't want to hit the headlines. There is a lot of cost associated with downtime, especially in trading applications that, as we are, you know, as we have a Credit Suisse. So it's definitely an interesting time, and you know, looking forward to a new year.
So I remember a time when the monitoring universe was essentially a heartbeat check, and the best we could do is just ping a server and see what response we got back, and then essentially we'd be, you know, in some version of a NOC looking at the blinking lights, and that was the tooling that we had. Just curious to hear all three of you, but among the four of us, we've got a lot of years in the saddle. What were some of your earliest experiences being in monitoring, or maybe what we now call observability? How'd you get your start?
It's going to date me, but I at EDS, I used to send the interns onto the data center floor to look for the red blinking lights, because we couldn't afford to monitor the hardware then. We were only monitoring the applications at that point, because the hardware monitoring just hadn't matured enough to tell us whether it was up or down. So the server itself would have a blinking light if something was about to go wrong, but we had no way to measure that without looking at the server. So I literally, for fun, would give the intern a piece of paper and say, go find these blinking lights and write the location down, and then go call the person who's in charge of it. That's a old school 25 years ago type of story.
Justin or Luca, can you beat that?
I can't beat it, unfortunately. I got my start back when I was working at Macromedia, and we were running OpenView, if any of you remember HP OpenView. And we were finding ways to move off it actually towards Nagios, to an open source platform. And so I just remember the kind of the thick OpenView client and how difficult it was to just get basic monitoring up and running. Kind of it's a long ways from where we are today, but that's where I got started in kind of this observability space.
From an automation perspective, I find monitoring kind of a tedious job in a sense, not to disrespect anyone monitoring something, but you know, setting up rules and watching something, you know, that's about to happen, it doesn't, you know, it never seemed right. I mean, my experience is more on the prevention and on the, you know, process improvement side. So I never been in a group that really monitor for a living, but I see that there has to be a better way, right? You know, the idea of sending an intern to the server room, it's, you know, I appeal to it, you know, it is really daunting. Like, poor intern.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to find new tasks for the interns, Liz.
Oh, right. Well, so now the interns actually come in as developers themselves, and we can immediately put them to work on the automation platform, which includes AI ops, and they're actually, you know, looking at repeat incidents and coding in some language that they learn in high school, right? Or even pre that, they walk right in and they're able to develop. So the interns have also evolved from when I was sending them into the server room looking at blinking lights. But yeah, we definitely have a new class of interns from when we were doing it 20 years ago. And that just is a reflection of how quickly the technology is moving, right? Every intern in college is obviously coding. They've been coding for many years by the time they get to college. And so they expect to walk into a job where they can do all that stuff.
I totally agree. So like we at Credit Suisse, we have a program that's for technical analysts, and they rotate from job to job and for the first 2-3 years of their career. And they go, you know, in antique language, they go from dev to support to QA. So what we see now is that, and I agree with you, so we see young engineers with coding skills the difference between these three paradigm are kind of, you know, merged together, and then people go in and code their way out of automation. It can be in a QA role, in a support role, in a development role, like that. That's blending, and everybody codes, which is, I guess, the spirit of DevOps, right?
Liz, I've been inspired by the work that you do to mentor people who are early in their career. I know, particularly encouraging females to pursue STEM-related careers. Curious for all three of you, but maybe we'll start with Liz. When you talk to people about maybe reskilling or upskilling, what do you think are the skills that will be required given the increasing sophistication of AI ops and automated ways of managing infrastructure? What are the human skills that you think are irreplaceable in the next, you know, even in the next 5 to 10 years?
Wow. So that's a good one about the human skills. So, you know, I do spend a lot of time mentoring, you know, young women and young men who are would like to move into leadership positions at some point in their careers. And, you know, to give them the list of here's all the technical skills you need is pretty easy. It's a standard, you know, taking all the classes. But some of the things that I ask them to work on is emotional intelligence, you know, being self-aware of how you present yourself and how, you know, other people are going to perceive the way you handle a situation. And, you know, self-awareness and emotional intelligence is so important as you move through life in general, but especially important in corporate America. And as we're now virtual, you know, you have to think a little bit about how your virtual brand, you know, if that's what we want to call it, is how it's being perceived by everyone else. And so we spend a lot of time in that space and getting constant feedback. And so it's kind of one-on-one in and what I mentor people on.
You took already the emotional intelligence part of the job. When I started a few years ago, I used to be proud of myself being able to see patterns in data. And, you know, this is a predate deep cloud computing. So now, I mean, that part is gone. I think the ability from a technical perspective, like I agree with you on the totally on the emotional intelligence side. From a technical perspective, everyone has to be some kind of a data scientist or of some sort, where you have the ability to prepare your data, analyze your data, and understand, you know, the statistics behind. So that, from a technical perspective, is definitely something that people should look at. And I had, when I advise my young TAs, I generally suggest to become an expert at these three things.
Yeah, I think from my perspective when I'm entering, it's really about trying to understand all the various opinions and viewpoints of kind of where other people in the organization or who you're working with are coming from, and try to not immediately stick to kind of your opinion and really kind of consolidate those opinions and understand where they're coming from, so that as you come to a solution, it's a solution that A, you're bringing everyone along with, and B, understanding kind of all the perspectives. Because almost always people have opinions or have done things for good reason, even if you can't see it at the moment. So really trying to understand kind of that holistic view on things and trying to go forward with it, whether it's a technical challenge or a management challenge or a personality challenge.
And I think that just to bring that all together, as we move into this, you know, SRE DevOps model, which everybody is moving towards, the key to the success there is the collaborative community that everybody works in. And that's that can be a big change for someone who's been in a traditional data center idle focus model. That can be a really big change, especially for you know, more senior folks who have not been in that type of collaborative space. To actually change that it takes a lot of awareness of how people work together.
Yeah, and all of this is a little bit tainted by, you know, the COVID events where we work remotely, and you know, you build your relationship at one point, like, you know, six, 3 to 5 months ago, depends on where you live. And now you need to cultivate them offline or via chat. So that is here to stay, I think. So if you can strive in a situation like this, I think it's a good skill set.
Now, when we are doing our jobs effectively, essentially nobody knows that we exist. And ironically, that can be kind of the holy grail, that no end customers, no internal users complain. But there's a kind of a corollary challenge, which is, how do we make sure that leadership appreciates the value of what we do? What are some of the techniques that you've used, or how do you interact with leadership when you're trying to explain to them, or maybe justify budget, or, you know, articulate the value of IT operations and healthy systems? Any techniques or words of wisdom that you have?
Yeah, I think that's a really big risk, right? I mean, if you're just not seen and not known, you look like a cost center. I think one of the biggest things that I focus with leadership is, and with the teams, is changing us from a keeping the systems up to a, hey, how are we moving the infrastructure and platforms forward? So what are the software projects? What are the automation projects? And how can we highlight the benefits to the business and then continue to report back on them? So treating, to me, and this is one of the biggest challenge or one of the biggest focuses I have is how do you treat IT ops or cloud infrastructure or cloud, whatever you want to call it, SRE DevOps, as moving towards kind of a software engineering organization, following the same paradigms that you'd see in software engineering and producing and following those same workflows. In that sense, you know, we have a product manager, we have a TPM in kind of my function. And so we really try to kind of slot in as part of engineering, producing deliverables that impact the business, as opposed to looking like a keep the lights on organization, which is kind of just a cost center.
And one of the things as an MSP we do is we constantly are sharing with the customer our innovation, and whether that's, you know, reduction in incidents or, you know, working with them on rate declines. The focus is always on innovation and not just keep the lights on. So, you know, you'd rather be talking to them about that something that is going to be having a positive light versus having to go and explain why something an outage happened, right? So there is your standard KPIs that you can show over time, but once you've shown that, you know, they're always great and number of incidents is declining, you have to be focused on innovation, both with the customer, which our customers really appreciate, but internally as well. So Dell Technologies is moving towards a software as a service companies. So a lot of the internal innovation that we're putting in place, for new offers, they're coming right back to the delivery teams who they know have automated a lot of the IT ops, and how can they extend those investments that we've made in that IP into new offers. So, but it really is just the one word is turn from just, housekeeping and keeping the lights on to how can you innovate and use that to further help your customers or your business.
In a bank, the focus is bottom line, obviously. And I think our technology department focuses on having an engineering culture, right? So that means seeking efficiencies on a daily basis. So that's the way we push this. Different projects or different budgets, we tie them to an efficiency call, and can be also a innovation angle in case you're completely shifting technologies, looking at incumbents and competitors. So it's a mix of a seek of efficiencies and disruptive innovation with a clear focus on bottom line.
Sometimes we're in the unfortunate role of having to push back on a requirement from the business. When they tell us, go split the atom or something, at some point we have to say, get the business value, want to be a profit center, but for a variety of technical reasons, what you're requesting is not likely to be successful because of our ability to, guarantee SLAs or, whatever kind of quality metrics you're asking us to agree to. Any examples that you can share of where you've had that, there's been some tension created with leadership because they're asking for something that IT ops or SREs just can't deliver?
So as an MSP, we do have a lot of our internal customers come to us and say.
I can jump in if you want, Dan. We'll hopefully be right back.
Go for it.
I see this almost every quarter with when we're doing quarterly planning, where we aren't able to necessarily meet all of the demands and asks of the business. And so what I find really helpful is to be super transparent and really list out all the projects and all the priorities that we're doing. And then when people are asking for these things, it's always it's not a no. It's never a no. It's a, okay, we can do that. We just have to look at kind of what else we drop in favor of this. So when we have all these priorities listed out and we're being extremely transparent, we can go to whoever's the requester and say, look, here's everything we have. If you feel like something's higher priority, let's have that conversation and let's have that negotiation. And then it becomes a question of what are the things that we're working on as opposed to what are we saying no to, and what is, it's a priority conversation from the business perspective, and we can align that back to business priorities. So in that sense, that's how we tend to try to push back on these things, and just through transparency and through kind of that prioritization process.
Right. When they come with a requirement, I always say everything is possible. Depends on how much money you have. That's normally what I go by. And that's yes, prioritization. Who's going to suffer from
it? Getting additional resources allocated when you push back.
It's it goes back to the maturity of your organization. I've been in organizations where you're mature, you need to find in. So that you generally tend to accommodate your, you make a bet on which is best customer in the future. In mature organization, like in the one that I run now, it becomes a lot easier where you're recognized as a provider of some sort. And, it's a easier confirmation. So also depends on what's your fame and what's your, past deliveries in that company.
I want to get past the cliches related to AI ops and maybe the combination of euphoria and skepticism about the role of AI to surface insights or to manage infrastructure, and get your individual perspectives on how and when and where will AI improve operations in your organizations, and any specific examples you can give of how you're onboarding it would be, I think, useful to the audience.
So we are at the point where I think, you know, if you have a well-trained AI, you can think about having, you know, a PhD transfer from generation to generation without having to study, right? So if you train something correctly, you know, you don't have to learn again from your past experience. So that's really intriguing, and I see a lot of projects now that I do in terms of automation where we are, you know, moving away from rule-based automation into kind of predictive and ML models to determine what, you know, the triggers and the data from various processes, right? So I'm super excited. And in fact, you know, at Credit Suisse, one of the things they were doing in terms of in regards to operation, we are seriously looking at Insight Finder and with successful pilots and even commitment to onboard on sophisticated, complex training platform. So I'm super excited. That will be a change in paradigm.
Maybe while we're on that topic, Lucas, share some of the use cases that have made the business excited about AI-driven automation.
Well, I mean, specifically, we were able to prove, you know, predictability and causal analysis on several use cases, going from hardware failure to alerts on job failures. So we cover a broad spectrum. You know, nobody believes that a machine can predict to a certain degrees, right? And we still stuck what I see on the, you know, setting, you know, rule and threshold based on past experience, trying, you know, to improve that so that it doesn't repeat anymore, or you can find your way out of some sort after the fact, right? But if you're going for total automation, in my opinion, you got to have a way to get ahead of the incident. Get manipulate the data in such a way that you can infer those possibilities that were never presented to you, right? So that's where, you know, where we are at Credit Suisse.
Yeah, it's stuff like obviously AI and data analytics and ML is obviously kind of core to who we are and what we do, given we're a kind of a data platform. So, you know, our infrastructure is 100% cloud-based and it's completely elastic. So for us, kind of having a static set of kind of monitoring and kind of configuring infrastructure and thresholds and such just doesn't work. So to us, kind of being able to build a system and a model to understand what's happening in our infrastructure as it kind of expands and contracts is critical. So from a monitoring perspective, that's an observability perspective, that's really important. We're also using a lot of AI and ML to do predictive analysis for failures or for capacity issues. So as we bring on large customers, we really have no insight into when they're going to grow and when they're going to contract. And so we're using kind of AI models and ML models to understand that and look for kind of when we start to see capacity issues or infrastructure constraints that you know the cloud providers may or may not tell us about. So we can kind of stay ahead of that. So we're trying to use it in all cases. I'd say the last case is in terms of infrastructure, we're collecting north of 1 million points per second in terms of data ingress volume of telemetry from our infrastructure. So there's no possible way that we could do analysis of that. And so without some kind of AI or ML looking for correlations, looking for variations, looking for deviations from kind of standard patterns or norms, we couldn't kind of manage our infrastructure. So we've kind of moved away from that traditional threshold setting much more towards kind of anomaly detection and look for cause and correlation and ideally kind of predictive analysis on kind of our infrastructure given just the volume and the scope that we have.
Let's see if we can bring Liz back into the conversation. It looks like Liz is back online.
Lost power at the house.
We needed a good IT ops team to make sure
exactly.
There were no outages. Your perspectives on AI as it pertains to how you've been onboarding it at Dell.
Yeah, so we are in the process of onboarding Insight Finder, and our main focus is on incident elimination, really, and also root cause. So we've had a successful pilot where we've been able to show that, you know, we can predict before the incident is going to happen so that we could get in front of that and reduce any SLA penalties that we might have, which is key for us, right? We don't want to pay any penalties. And then we can quickly understand what the root cause is. So, you know, in when you do have a P1 incident, trying to understand what the root cause is can take some time to get to pull all the relevant data together. And so using some of what we've found in Insight Finder has been extremely helpful. And then we're also going to use the data that we find for repeat incidents to be able to give it to the, put it into the SRE backlog and look for new ways that we can, you know, automate that or new endpoints we need to be monitoring, et cetera. And it just is a wealth of information for our SRE team to use as a platform of where they need to look next.
And before we enter the last phase of the conversation, I want to get one last one in here related to the present. And I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the effect of the pandemic on your organization's role, how you manage expectations, how you look to technology, how you look to automation. Open-ended question, what have the last 6 to 9 months done to you personally and to your organizations?
The last 6 months have been very interesting. You know, as the market volatility increased, we saw 3 to 5x volumes, and everybody was really concerned. On top of it, everyone was forced to work from home. So we found out actually that we had a very resilient infrastructure. So everybody was, you know, everyone from the business side congratulated the IT side, which is, you know, for the past 20 years been seen as a cost. On top of it, where we have automation in place, just leave alone the monitoring of systems, but where there was automation, we had emails coming thanking for, you know, these many processes, you know, that were automated before the pandemic. Otherwise, they would not have been able to deal with it and scale, right? So I think is, the silver lining is that we're going to see more and more of automation and AI going forward, in my opinion, after this pandemic.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Dell was able to, in a weekend, move our global team home. And a lot of other service providers really struggled with that. But our whole global team moved home over the weekend. Our infrastructure at Dell was able to handle, you know, 140,000 people working from home with no issues. And so what we saw was all of our customers had a change. Some had an increase and some had a decrease in the incidents, changes, et cetera, that were happening in the environment. And it was in some cases, you know, cruise lines park their ships, and so nothing happening there. Their environments are really almost in cold storage now. But then we have some other grocery stores where, when there was a run on toilet paper, we were having to watch the environment to make sure that we had enough capacity for all the transactions that were happening. And we could see the correlation between what was happening in the news and what was happening in their IT environment. So that was really a fascinating thing for the team. But as we move into, you know, 6 months now that we've been in this situation, I think we all recognize that there's no going back to the way it used to be. You know, we were able to prove that we successfully can work at home. The cost to having buildings and people commute to work is Dell is looking at that as the new normal, and how can we adjust to it. So I think that we're still in the adjustment phase. Right now we've reached the point where, you know, we're just recognizing there are no boundaries between work and home, and people are starting to get burned out. But you know, the technology is definitely going to help us as we determine what are the boundaries are between what people are doing at home and what they need to let the technology do for them.
Liz, if it's okay, we're going to trademark the term. Instead of KTLO, which has become kind of tired, it's going to be KTTP OTS, keeping the toilet paper on the shelves. How do you like that? And we're with that.
There you go.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, Liz is going to get credit for that one, but I like that because for too many years we've talked about keeping the lights on.
Yeah. No, this is definitely keeping the toilet paper on the shelf. Yeah.
Justin, your perspectives?
Yeah, from my perspective, Snowflake as an organization, we've actually seen increased usage of kind of our data platform and kind of analytics. We see some shifting in terms of how it's being used, but we've seen kind of continued usage as well as increase. I think just as people are running various scenarios and trying to understand their business more from a data perspective, because everyone's not in the room to have kind of their gut feel, they're really focused on data and getting analytics from that data. I think the one thing I'd agree with the other panelists that it's definitely not going back. And we've seen, when we were able to shift overnight to having everyone run remote, the positive thing is that we looked at our offices as nothing more than kind of internet connections that you would have anywhere else. So it was a fairly easy shift, whether in a coffee shop, home, or in the office, it's just an internet connection. And so that really helped in terms of the transition to working at home, because it wasn't much different. The one thing I'd say that we have spent a bit more time on and focus on, and we're getting quite a bit more questions from customers on, is on our disaster recovery and business continuity plans. Because I think that this pandemic is something that no one ever thought would happen. And it's these situations that you always plan for, but never really thought would happen. A meteor hitting the earth and taking out, some large metro area. But interestingly enough, this is exactly what that is, right? I mean, literally everyone is working from home, and how do you think about different geographies and not being able to fly to various locations, or if you have, password recoveries or things like that in any kind of physical environment? Like, for example, it's very difficult for us to go back into the office. We can, but it takes quite a bit of time and a bunch of approvals and things like that. So even physically getting in the office to get something if you need some kind of recovery or something is almost impossible. So we've really looked hard at kind of our BCP DR plans, both from a corporate IT perspective as well as from a production perspective, really kind of beefed those up, ensure they're solid, and that's definitely a positive thing for our customers. But we're getting quite a few questions on that. So I think people are taking that area a bit more seriously than they might have in the past, is less of a checkbox and more of a this could actually happen.
We get time for one last question. We've talked a bit about the need to reskill, upskill. We've talked a little bit about use cases involving automation. Question for you is, will you ever automate yourself out of a job? What's your perspective on whether or not that would be a good or a bad thing?
Yeah, I don't think it's, maybe it's automate out of your current job. To me, and this is what I talk to my staff about as much as I possibly can, which is how do we automate you out of the routine mundane tasks and have you writing software or writing tools and to enhance the platform, right, and get business value. And so maybe automate out of your current job is the right thing, but out of a job, I don't foresee that. And I think that what this is an opportunity for people to continue to move up the stack and deliver more business value and have more interesting jobs, do more interesting things, as opposed to kind of the routine mundane, monitoring or operational tasks. And so yeah, automate out of your current job, but into a better job, hopefully, is how I try to phrase it.
Yeah, there's always going to be innovation in the future. And so, I really like how Justin said, automate out of your current role. So I'm already in a strategic innovation role, and I don't see that particular role ever going away. Although, we are always looking for ways that we can automate, just about everything, right? And we'll look at every task that is available there. But we, innovation is not something that is going to be, quote, automated anytime soon.
Well, my answer, you can get from the picture that you got from LinkedIn. Yes, automate yourself out of your job so you can go sailing. But yeah, I agree. My current job, next job, sailor.
What if you have a self-driving boat?
Oh, those exist already. They're beautiful. It's a wind vane.
I'll call Alon and tell him to make sure you take the first shipment of his self-driving boat.
Okay. Yep.
Let's see. I'd like to take at least one or two of the questions from the chat panel. Thank you to everyone in the audience for providing good questions. We're not going to have time to get to everyone's questions, but I'm going to cherry pick. Here's one that I think is provocative. So we're just starting out an SRE organization. What tips do you have for us about what not to do?
Yeah, and I have a fairly, extreme view, but certainly to me, I we take a fairly strong stance of when you're looking at SRE, build an engineering org, not an operations org, right? You're writing code, you're writing infrastructure as code, and so you should be looking for staff that is going to build software, is going to build tooling, not who's knows how to run specific technologies or specific infrastructure in a way. And the more you get in the mindset of engineering as opposed to operation, in my personal view, you start to build systems that are self-managing, automated, self-healing, and you get away from kind of the linear growth that you'd see in more traditional operations organizations where you scale staff as infrastructure grows. So I would look at that. I think the other piece is really embedding with the engineering teams you're working with. And so centrally managed is fine, but really understanding and being a part of the standups, the scrums or whatever kind of workflow the engineering teams have, and be a part of that team so that you're part of that engineering team as opposed to viewed as something where code is thrown over the wall and you have to quote unquote operate it.
Yeah, actually, I have the same view here, is that it's extremely difficult to take an existing team and change them or train them to be our SREs. They may understand the skills, but it's really a mindset change, right? And it's how your critical thinking skills and your problem solving skills, how they change. And you may look at taking your existing operation team and evolving them, and you may have one, maybe two from your existing team in the overall SRE team, but you really need to bring in folks who have that mindset starting off with, because that's where you'll quickly get to if you don't have that, the operations team going back to the old thought process of, well, we can't do that because customer always, told us we couldn't do it. So it's a mindset shift more than anything.
Yeah, what not to do specifically is not to get defensive and embrace the change. It will take time, as you need to upskill. You should keep your current team and have them retrained. That works incredibly well for morale and looking backwards. You can say that you made it. Do not stress, embrace the change.
Well, it feels like we're just getting started, but we're gonna have to wrap up. Like I said, for everyone in the audience whose questions we didn't get a chance to answer, we'll try to make sure we follow up offline. This has been a fantastic discussion. And my only ask to our great panelists, Liz and Justin and Luca, is maybe as this future gets less murky and it becomes a reality, maybe we could have you back and we'll host another one of these discussions. Does that sound okay to you?
Sounds great.
Absolutely.
Good. Well, I really have enjoyed this today. Thanks again to our great panelists. Thanks to everyone who has been listening. We appreciate you joining us. We'll be back on next month with another panel discussion with experts in the space. Thanks again. Have a wonderful morning, afternoon, or evening.